Chapter 17. Kickleberry asks his mother, "That is our ambassadress at X, ma'am. I saw her yesterday buying a penny toy for one of her little children in Frankfurt Fair." Lady Kickleberry looks towards Lady X. She makes Her Excellency an undeveloped curtsy, as it were. She waves her plumed head. Lady K is got up in great style, in a rich dejeuner toilette. Perfectly regardless of expense, she salutes the ambassadress with a sweeping gesture from her chair, and backs before her as before royalty, and turns to her daughter's large eyes full of meaning, and spreads out her silks in state. "And who is that distinguished-looking man who just passed, and who gave you a reserved nod?" asks her ladyship. "Is that Lord X?" Kickleberry burst out laughing. "Hat, ma'am, is Mr. Higmore, of Conduit Street, tailor, draper, and habit maker. And I owe him £100. The insolence of that sort of people is really intolerable," says Lady Kickleberry. "Here must be some distinction of classes. They ought not to be allowed to go everywhere. And who is yonder, that lady with the two boys, and the very high complexion?" Lady Kickleberry asks. "That is a Russian princess. And one of those little boys, the one who is sucking a piece of barley sugar, plays, and wins 500 louis in a night." "Kickleberry, you do not play? Promise your mother you do not. Swear to me at this moment you do not. Where are the horrid gambling rooms? There, at that door where the crowd is? Of course, I shall never enter them." "Of course not, ma'am," says the affectionate son on duty. "And if you come to the balls here, please don't let Fanny dance with anybody until you ask me first. You understand? Fanny, you will take care." "Yes, Tom," says Fanny. "What, Hicks, how are you, old fellow? How is Platts? Who would have thought of you being here? When did you come?" "I had the pleasure of traveling with Lady Kickleberry and her daughters in the London boat to Antwerp," says Captain Hicks, making the ladies a bow. Kickleberry introduces Hicks to his mother as his most particular friend, and he whispers Fanny that he's as good a fellow as ever lived, Hicks is. Fanny says, "He seems very kind and good-natured." And Captain Hicks waltzes very well," says Miss Fanny with a blush, "and I hope I may have him for one of my partners." What a babel of tongues it is in this splendid hall with gleaming marble pillars. A ceaseless rushing whisper, as if the band were playing its music by a waterfall. The British lawyers are all got together, and my friend Langton, on his arrival, has been carried off by his brother sergeants, and becomes once more a lawyer. "Well, Brother Langton," says old Sir Thomas Minos, with his venerable kind face, "you have got your rule, I see." And they fall into talk about their law matters, as they always do, wherever they are at a club, in a ballroom, at a dinner table, at the top of Chimborazo. Some of the young barristers appear as bucks with uncommon splendor, and dance and hang about the ladies. But they have not the easy languid douce-may-care air of the young bucks of the Hicks and Kickleberry school. They can't put on their clothes with that happy negligence. Their neckcloths sit quite differently on them, somehow. They become very hot when they dance, and yet do not spin round near so quickly as those London youths, who have acquired experience in corpor vili, and learned to dance easily by the practice of 1,000 casinos. Above the babel tongues and the clang of the music, as you listen in the great saloon, you hear from a neighboring room a certain sharp ringing clatter, and a hard clear voice cries out, "Zero Rouge, or Trent Cinq Noir. Impaire pass." And then there is a pause of a couple of minutes, and then the voice says, "Fate's la jeu, messieurs." La jeu est fate, reneva plus, and the sharp ringing clatter recommences. You know what that room is? That is Hades. That is where the spirited proprietor of the establishment takes his toll, and thither the people go who pay the money which supports the spirited proprietor of this fine palace and gardens. Let us enter Hades, and see what is going on there. Hades is not an unpleasant place. Most of the people look rather cheerful. You don't see any frantic gamblers gnashing their teeth or dashing down their last stakes. The winners have the most anxious faces, or the poor shabby fellows who have got systems, and are pricking down the alternations of red and black on cards, and don't seem to be playing at all. On fate days the country people come in, men and women, to gamble, and they seem to be excited as they put down their hard-earned florins with trembling rough hands, and watch the turn of the wheel. But what you call the good company is very quiet and easy. A man loses his mass of gold, and gets up and walks off, without any particular mark of despair. The only gentleman whom I saw in Warburg who seemed really affected was a certain Count de Mustachev, a Russian of enormous wealth, who clenched his fists, beat his breast, cursed his stars, and absolutely cried with grief. Not for losing money, but for neglecting to win, and play upon a coup de vingt, a series in which the red was turned up 20 times running. Which series, had he but played, it is clear that he might have broken M. Lenoir's bank, and shut up the gambling house, and doubled his own fortune, when he would have been no happier, and all the balls and music, all the newspaper rooms and parks, all the feasting and pleasure of this delightful Regentin Warburg would have been at an end. For though he is a wicked gambling prince, Lenoir, he is beloved in all these regions. His establishment gives life to the town, to the lodging house and hotel keepers, to the milliners and hackney coachmen, to the letters of horse flesh, to the huntsmen and gardes de chasse, to all these honest fiddlers and trumpeters who play so delectably. Were Lenoir's bank to break, the whole little city would shut up, and all the Noirburgers wish him prosperity, and benefit by his good fortune. 3 years since the Noirburgers underwent a mighty panic. There came, at a time when the chief Lenoir was at Paris, and the reins of government were in the hands of his younger brother, a company of adventurers from Belgium, with a capital of 300,000 francs, and an infallible system for playing roulette noir, and they boldly challenged the bank of Lenoir, and sat down before his croupiers, and defied him. They called themselves in their pride the Contrebank de Noirburg. They had their croupiers and punters, even as Lenoir had his. They had their rouleau of Napoleons, stamped with their contrabankish seal. And they began to play. As when two mighty giants step out of a host and engage, the armies stand still in expectation, and the puny privates and commonalty remain quiet to witness the combat of the tremendous champions of the war. So it is said, that when the contrabank arrived, and ranged itself before the officers of Lenoir rouleau to rouleau, banknote to banknote, war for war, controlment for controlment, all the minor punters and gamblers ceased their peddling play, and looked on in silence, round the verdant plain, where the great combat was to be decided. Not used to the vast operations of war, like his elder brother, Lenoir Jr., the lieutenant, telegraphed to his absent chief the news of the mighty enemy who had come down upon him, asked for instructions, and in the meanwhile met the foe man like a man. The contrabank of Noirburg gallantly opened its campaign. The Lenoir bank was defeated day after day, in numerous savage encounters. The tactics of the contrabankist generals were irresistible. Their infernal system bore down everything before it, and they marched onwards terrible and victorious as the Macedonian phalanx. Tuesday, a loss of 18,000 florins. Wednesday, a loss of 12,000 florins. Thursday, a loss of 40,000 florins. Night after night, the young Lenoir had to chronicle these disasters in melancholy dispatches to his chief. What was to be done? Night after night, the Noirburgers retired home doubtful and disconsolate. The horrid contrabankists gathered up their spoils, and retired to a victorious supper. How was it to end? Far away at Paris, the elder Lenoir answered these appeals of his brother by sending reinforcements of money. Chests of gold arrived for the bank. The Prince of Noirburg bade his beleaguered lieutenant not to lose heart. He himself never for a moment blenched in this trying hour of danger. The contrabandists still went on victorious. Rouleau after rouleau fell into their possession. At last the news came. The emperor has joined the Grand Army. Lenoir himself had arrived from Paris, and was once more among his children, his people. The daily combats continued. And still, though Napoleon was with the Eagles, the abominable contrabandists fought and conquered. And far greater than Napoleon, as great as Ney himself under disaster, the bold Lenoir never lost courage, never lost good humor, was affable, was gentle, was careful of his subjects' pleasures and comforts, and met an adverse fortune with a dauntless smile. With a devilish forbearance and coolness, the atrocious contraband like Polyphemus, who only took one of his prisoners out of the cave at a time, and so ate them off at leisure the horrid contrabandists, I say, contented themselves with winning, so much before dinner, and so much before supper, say 5,000 florins for each meal. They played and won at noon. They played and won at eventide. They of Noirbourg went home sadly every night. The invader was carrying all before him. What must have been the feelings of the great Lenoir? What were those of Washington before Trenton, when it seemed all up with the cause of American independence? What those of the Virgin Elizabeth, when the Armada was signaled? What those of Miltiades, when the multitudinous Persian bore down on Marathon? The people looked on at the combat, and saw their chieftain stricken, bleeding, fallen, fighting still. At last there came one day, when the contrabandists had won their allotted sum, and were about to leave the tables which they had swept so often. But pride and lust of gold had seized upon the heart of one of their vainglorious chieftains, and he said, "Do not let us go yet, let us win 1,000 florins more." So they stayed, and set the bank, yet 1,000 florins. The Noirbourgers looked on, and trembled for their prince. Some 3 hours afterwards a mighty shout was heard around the windows of that palace. The town, the gardens, the hills, the fountains took up, and echoed the jubilant acclaim. Hip, 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 hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. People rushed into each other's arms. Men, women, and children cried, and kissed each other. Croupiers, who never feel, who never tremble, who never care, whether black wins or red loses, took snuff from each other's boxes, and laughed for joy, and Lenoir the dauntless, the invincible Lenoir, wiped the drops of perspiration from his calm forehead, as he drew the enemy's last rouleau into his till. He had conquered. The Persians were beaten, horse and foot the armada had gone down. Since Wellington shut up his telescope at Waterloo, when the Prussians came charging onto the field, and the guard broke and fled, there had been no such heroic endurance, such utter defeat, such signal and crowning victory. Vive Lenoir! I am a Lenoirite. I have read his newspapers, strolled in his gardens, listened to his music, and rejoice in his victory. I am glad he beat those contrabandists. Dissipate, I sunt. The game is up with them. The instances of this man's magnanimity are numerous, and worthy of Alexander the Great, or Harry the Fifth, or Robin Hood. Most gentle is he, and thoughtful to the poor, and merciful to the vanquished. When Jeremy Diddler, who had lost £20 at his table, lay in inglorious pawn at his inn, when O'Toole could not leave Noirbourg until he had received his remittances from Ireland, the noble Lenoir paid Diddler's inn bill, advanced O'Toole money upon his well-known signature, franked both of them back to their native country again, and has never, wonderful to state, been paid from that day to this. If you will go play at his table, you may. But nobody forces you. If you lose, pay with a cheerful heart. Dulce est desipere in loco. This is not a treatise of morals. Friar Tuck was not an exemplary ecclesiastic, nor Robin Hood a model man, but he was a jolly outlaw, and I dare say the Sheriff of Nottingham, whose money he took, rather relished his feast at Robin's green table. And if you lose, worthy friend, as possibly you will, at Lenoir's pretty games, console yourself by thinking that it is much better for you in the end that you should lose than that you should win. Let me, for my part, make a clean breast of it, and own that your humble servant did, on one occasion, win a score of Napoleons, and beginning with a sum of no less than 5 shillings. But until I had lost them again I was so feverish, excited, and uneasy, that I had neither delectation in reading the most exciting French novels, nor pleasure in seeing pretty landscapes, nor appetite for dinner. The moment, however, that graceless money was gone, equanimity was restored. Paul Feeble and Eugene Sue began to be terrifically interesting again, and the dinners at Noirborg, though by no means good culinary specimens, were perfectly sufficient for my easy and tranquil mind. Langan, who played only a lawyer's rubber at whist, marked the salutary change in his friend's condition, and, for my part, I hope and pray that every honest reader of this volume who plays at M. Lenoir's table will lose every shilling of his winnings before he goes away. Where are the gamblers whom we have read of? Where are the card players whom we can remember in our early days? At one time almost every gentleman played, and there were whist tables in every lady's drawing room. But trumps are going out along with numbers of old world institutions, and, before very long, a blackleg will be as rare an animal as a knight in armor. There was a little dwarfish, abortive, counterbank set up at Noirborg this year. But the gentlemen soon disagreed among themselves, and, let us hope, were cut off in detail by the great Lenoir. And there was a Frenchman at our inn who had won 2 Napoleons per day for the last 6 weeks, and who had an infallible system, whereof he kindly offered to communicate the secret for the consideration of 100 louis. But there came one fatal night, when the poor Frenchman's system could not make head against fortune, and her wheel went over him, and he disappeared utterly. With the early morning everybody rises and makes his or her appearance at the springs, where they partake of water with a wonderful energy and perseverance. They say that people get to be fond of this water at last. As to what tastes cannot men accustom themselves? I drank a couple of glasses of an abominable sort of feeble salts in a state of very gentle effervescence. But, though there was a very pretty girl who served it, the drink was abominable, and it was a marvel to see the various topers, who tossed off glass after glass, which the fair-haired little Hebe delivered sparkling from the well. Seeing my wry faces, old Captain Carver expostulated, with a jolly twinkle of his eye, as he absorbed the contents of a sparkling crystal beaker. Ooh! Take another glass, sir. You'll like it better and better every day. It refreshes you, sir. It fortifies you. And as for liking it, gad, I remember the time when I didn't like claret. Times are altered now, ha! Ha! Mrs. Fantail, madam, I wish you a very good morning. How is Fantail? He don't come to drink the water. So much the worse for him. To see Mrs. Fantail of an evening is to behold a magnificent sight. She ought to be shown in a room by herself, and, indeed, would occupy a moderate-sized one with her person and adornments. Marie Antoine's hoop is not bigger than Mrs. Fantail's flounces. 20 men taking hands, and, indeed, she likes to have at least that number about her, would scarcely encompass her. Her chestnut ringlets spread out in a halo round her face. She must want 2 or 3 coiffures to arrange that prodigious headdress, and then, when it is done, how can she endure that extraordinary gown? Her Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.